Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
This episode contains references to abuse and may not be for all listeners. From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Lolita, Vladimir Nabokov's novel about a man's sexual obsession with a young girl, is a controversial novel, to say the least. But when Bindu Bansanath started to read it, it unexpectedly became a kind of roadmap for her, showing her a way out of the situation she was in. She tells the story in her piece, How Lolita Freed Me From My Own Humbert. It's read by Jamila Jamil. Jamila starred in The Good Place on NBC, and she's host of the new podcast, I Weigh, with Jamila Jamil.
It was my uncle who gave me my first copy of Lolita. My father had refused to buy it for me at the bookstore we often visited together. "Why that book?" my father said as he and I arrived home. "I just want it." We removed our shoes at the door, where religious superstition required all things unclean to be left. I wanted to read it. I was 15, a sophomore in high school, and had learned of Lolita from an English teacher who had summarized the plot, citing it as an example of unreliable narration. My uncle knew the basics, the trope of the precocious girl, the Japanese fashion subculture, the heart-shaped glasses, but he'd not actually read the novel when he gave it to me as a gift a few weeks later, after I told him my father wouldn't buy it. My uncle liked to buy me gifts, both little and lavish. What my parents could not afford, what they forbade me to have. The benefactor role made him feel as if he were filling in gaps that my parents' conservatism had left in my life. So in whichever hotel room we were staying that night, with me tucked into bed, conned, out of clothes, he tossed me the forbidden paperback and said, "You'd better hide this. Your mother will have a fit if she sees you reading it. You know she doesn't trust you like I do." He issued this warning even though I hid everything from my mother, as he trained me to do. He knew that to groom girls, you must erase mothers. I knew he had groomed girls before me from the tragic stories he told of Indian girls he had been with in England, stories in which he remembered himself as more savior than predator. I didn't know their names, but across his years of abuse, we formed a tight-lipped sisterhood, our silence keeping him out of jail. I wanted to read Lolita because I believed it would mitigate my sexual shame. The similarity between the novel's plot and my day-to-day life had sent me on a Google search, where I read excerpts and watched trailers of both film adaptations categorized under crime, drama, and romance. Until then, it had never occurred to me to consider my relationship with my uncle under any of those genres, that anyone could think us a romance nauseated me, while crime and drama seemed overblown. He came into my life when I was 12 and he was 53, a close family friend in a country, the United States, where my family had few relations. Childless himself, married to a mystery woman, he became my uncle in the routine way I was taught to call Indian men uncle and Indian women auntie. He was also a progressive voice in my conservative household, sympathetic to the Americanness in me that my mother viewed as dangerous, especially regarding sex. While my friends were getting birds and bees talks, my mother prohibited tampons. I did not know what a menstrual period was until I got mine. Womanhood was far off, a state of emergency that befell other people. We operated as if men did not exist. But I had curiosities and crushes, and I came to confide these to my uncle over the handful of day trips and conversations it took him to secure my trust, and for me to love him, as briefly I did. As a girl can come to love a man who is like a father to her. Under the false pretense of his wife joining us, he turned our day trips into overnights. On weekends, he drove us into Manhattan, delivering me to acting classes and then picking me up for dinners and Broadway plays. Although I was taught to accept nothing from anyone, he bought me a wardrobe of risque women's clothing and warned that rejecting his gifts would be ungrateful. At an age when I considered myself invisible to men, he found gratification in pointing out when a man on the street looked at me. I gazed at myself in the mirrors of the ritzy hotels where we stayed in rooms so extravagant that I was self-conscious about taking up space. Manhattan hotel rooms became Boston hotel rooms, became Connecticut hotel rooms, became seaside resorts and other locations I've worked diligently to forget. I did not acknowledge that the cost of his care was molestation. To acknowledge that would make it true. So I accepted his explanations that what he did to me was either universal or imaginary, and that my pain was a product of my own tearful hysterics. "Calm down," he would say, his large, damp hand resting on my thigh. "Everyone is taught how to do this, how to kiss. I don't get any pleasure from it. You're mischaracterizing things." I ran with this theory of myself as an unreliable narrator. When I began attending a Catholic girls' high school, a world of women materialized. My parents believed an all-girls education would put me on the path to an Ivy League college without the distraction of boys and their gazes. To function as a schoolgirl, I cordoned off the memories of the other life I led, a life dictated by the gaze of a middle-aged man. Instead, I dreamed of growing up and getting away from him. When, during a car ride, I spoke about my hopes for college, he promised to get an apartment wherever I attended. He dreamed I would come home to him after class and live with him like a surrogate wife. I wept, devastated by the prospect of a future without exit. At the intersection, he kissed my forehead, apparently mistaking my tears for joy. Over time, it became harder to deny the reality of the abuse. But still, I felt I could tell no one. Exposing my uncle would ruin him, and I considered myself too unimportant to upend a grown man's life. So I endured, pushing my family away and pulling my uncle close, and, I hoped, past suspicion. I felt as if I were growing into two identities, the woman I was and the woman as object eclipsing her. And in Lolita, I found a strange validation, that there was glamour to be had as an object of desire. If a paedophile's gaze could be normalized and even beautified, then perhaps I could normalize and beautify my own situation. It was easier to digest an image of myself as a nymphette than to confront the reality of my victimhood. Over time, the novel became more than a coping mechanism. It became a guide. I came to see how Lolita uses Humbert's obsession with her as a means to gain power over him. In the blue kidnapping car in which the two travel cross-country, she uses this power to accuse him of rape, of being a dirty man. While Humbert fumbles to justify booking one hotel room for them both, she names their situation for the incest it is. She knows she is Humbert's vulnerability and learns how to use herself against him. Eventually, so did I. The winter I first read Lolita, my uncle was trying to remain in my mother's good graces, hoping he could convince her to appoint him as my legal guardian if tragedy ever struck. He was thrilled by the growing friction between my mother and me, fights precipitated by the sexy way I had started to dress and by her suspicion that I sneaked around with college men after school. Which I did. His abuse had made me promiscuous to the point of recklessness, grateful for the simple fact that my body could still want. And I found that the more I wanted other men, the less I was willing to tolerate him. When he surprised me with an apartment he'd rented for us near my school, I told him for the first time that I hated him, that he was as much a pervert as the man in the book. And once the accusations began, I could not stop. Although he already helped to finance my school fees, I also demanded envelopes of money, determined to be ungrateful, to exact collateral. Over dinners, I told him about men I had been with and what we had done, at which point he would set aside his plate and moan that he had lost his appetite. It would be a few months before I reached my breaking point and exposed him to a school teacher, someone I knew would be legally bound to report him. Soon after, at the police station, I supplied an affidavit. I sat in a room full of officers who prompted and recorded me through an incriminating phone call with my uncle, the contents of which were then played back to him after his arrest, after he had dismissed the molestation charges as my mischaracterizing things. I had not mischaracterized. The story I told was neither unreliable nor glamorous, and it didn't belong to him. It was and is mine.
That's Jamila Jamil reading Bindu Bansanath's essay, How Lolita Freed Me from My Own Humbert. We'll catch up with Bindu after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing?
It's actually a really complicated question.
To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Bindu Bansanath was 21 when her essay was published in February 2018, in the middle of the Me Too movement. She says she thought a lot about what it would be like to publish this story.
For so long, I had carried it, that experience around with me as a secret, as something I was supposed to hide. And then now I was going to put it out for the whole world to read and see. Also, at that time, I think a lot of Me Too voices were coming out, and there weren't very many from South Asian women. And I felt like what I could possibly do in terms of reach with this essay was maybe more important than my anxieties about putting it out.
And the essay did reach a lot of people.
Friends I had not spoken to in years, friends who kind of knew me at the time that these events were unraveling in my life, had all messaged me with really thoughtful things and a lot of kind of, I didn't know that you were going through this. That was one side of it. And then the other side was strangers. And I was really kind of worried how it would be received. But then I was kind of warmed and heartened to see how many people called it brave, or, you know, privately shared with me that they had had similar experiences and they were very moved by the essay. And that was, that was quite something to hear.
Bindu doesn't know whether the man who abused her has read the piece. He spent several months in jail, but he's been released. Now he's a registered sex offender. And Bindu says that after he was released, she did worry about her own safety.
I was nervous because in the end, I really did speak out against him. And I always felt the anxiety of I had changed the course of his life, even though he changed the course of my life. And yeah, I was always afraid that like he would feel vengeful about that. And I would have to face that in some way. But at the same time, it kind of goes back to there's a part of me that hopes that he read it and knows that manipulating me into silence or manipulating anybody into silence is not, it won't work.
Bindu says that while crafting her own narrative was powerful, it wasn't the end of the healing process.
In fact, the aftermath of these experiences definitely does crop up in my daily life and my relationships and kind of in everything. And that is frustrating. I think that I really struggle with romantic relationships. And this is a really frustrating thing because you would think that I had this terrible experience. I don't want to have any more terrible experiences. I want to meet like good people or kind people. But in fact, it kind of, you know, you sometimes seek people that replicate patterns that were going on in that relationship. And I know that I can be in unhealthy relationships. I know that I enter them and that I stay in them longer than I should. And I can understand it, but then I'll still do it. And I feel like there's so many things that I have to rewrite in my body and rewrite in terms of like, what does love mean to me? What does a good relationship look like? So I'm still searching for that. I think it's very easy and kind of inevitable that if you go through something like this, you learn to devalue yourself because somebody is devaluing you. And it can be really hard to work from a place of like that little self-esteem and that little sense of self-worth. An important part of healing is, sounds very cliche, but like loving yourself and being aware of what your worth is. And if I can't afford myself that kind of graciousness and humanity, then I think about, what if my friend was in the situation? Would I let them accept what I am accepting? And obviously the answer is no. So I just think it's like driving home that you are worth so much. And if you can't see it, think about the people you love as well and treat yourself like one of them.
That's Bindu Bansinath. She's currently at work on an MFA at Columbia University and writing her first novel. Her modern love essay will be included in an upcoming anthology called Lolita in the Afterlife. That's out in 2021. Also, today is her birthday, so happy birthday, Bindu.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for The New York Times.
Bindu is one of the youngest writers I've worked with in Modern Love, and also one of the best and the bravest in telling this story. I first learned about this story when she was a freshman in college and wrote about it for one of our college essay contests. And when she was a senior, she wrote this version of it that had to do with reading Lolita that really accessed the story in a way that could work more broadly. With stories that are this troubling and difficult to write about and difficult to expose yourself as having experienced, it's really my job to protect the writer and make sure that this is something that she wants to go forward with. And Bindu and I had conversation after conversation to make sure that she wanted to publish this story, which would expose such a troubling part of her past. And she was confident. She never wavered. And she'd really mastered the story in a way. She knew how she wanted to tell it and what she wanted to say. But ultimately, she said, silence doesn't work with this. Keeping these stories to ourselves doesn't work. It's silence that allows this behavior to continue and for girls to be damaged by it. And she was just determined to go forward. And I was very proud of it and proud of her. It was a brave piece, a strong piece of writing, and set her off on what has already been a very successful writing career.
And here's Jamila Jamil.
The reason I chose the story is because I thought it was beautifully written. I also have so many issues with the book, Lolita, and it was interesting to see it used as this sort of tool for the writer. And mostly it's because this is the story that isn't told enough when we think of things like child abuse. We always see them mostly very, very sensationalized and violently portrayed in the media. And so I think that that stops us from being able to recognize it in its more pervasive and insidious forms, forms like the way that the writers have written about it. And those are stories that we need to hear more of, the stories that happen slowly over time where there is gaslighting involved. And so I wanted to be a part of telling that story.
Thanks to Jamila for reading this week's essay. Her podcast is I Weigh with Jamila Jamil. It's from Earwolf. You can listen to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. We're edited by Catherine Brewer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional thanks to Mia Lee, Julia Simon, and Anya Stremian at The New York Times, and to Michael Garth at WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.